Hey, it's Dome Theory. Bobby Manning from Syracuse, New York, where we're broadcasting live from the apartment of our producer, Taylor McLeod.
Yes, sir.
Just 2 days after Duke Syracuse, which is the event here. This is what everybody gets hyped up for. The Dome fills up, ESPN comes in and starts doing their montages of how great Syracuse is, how historic the program is, and frankly, I wasn't sure Syracuse was going to survive to this point in the season and still be a viable March Madness candidate, even be a team that could stand with a Duke Blue Devils team that has two phenomenal recruits in Cassius Stanley and Vernon Carey Jr. again. And even though they lost 97-88, I came away pretty impressed with the product, astonished by how well Syracuse competed in this one. They held the lead for 19 minutes. They closed to within five in the last 3 minutes. And that crowd, Taylor, who's standing by me, was phenomenal. They had it all packed to the corner. The court takes up about a fourth of the stadium. And then you can push the crowd behind the court because there's a grandstand. And then the stands for the football games that people sit in too. And they can fit people behind the grandstand. So they can barely see the court. But if you're on the upper level, they'll go back halfway through the football setup. And that's what you had in this game. They were swag surfing. They were getting on.
That was terrible.
They were getting on the free throw shooters really good. I came away just very impressed with everything about this, except the fact that Adam Weitzman, who's just been bringing Carmelo Anthony, Entourage characters, all these different people games all season. I don't think anyone was talking about a guest for this game. How do you come to the Duke game without a guest?
I don't know. You'd think this would be the game for a guest because of how excited campus does get for Cuse Duke. Obviously, we've had, what, three of them since we got here? Since freshman year 2016? Yep. Yeah.
So the first one was the buzzer beater.
John Gillen. And then
the second one was last year's letdown. Zion doesn't play. RJ Barrett just completely picks them apart. And it ended up being a blowout.
Because Cuse won down at Cameron last year, and then the Zion injury, so we didn't play up here. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was an interesting game. I think what you said about them not surviving until this point in the season, that was a concern I had initially when seeing this on the schedule and seeing just kind of how the team was constructed, but obviously they've been a little better than, I think, at least what I expected. You know, I didn't have a bad time at the game. The crowd was good, big crowd, over 30,000. I was up in the second deck and watching the Cuse offense run what looked like, you know, more legitimate sets than in the past. It was really nice.
Yeah, and they have an NBA guy in Elijah Hughes. That's why people should tune in. I don't think a lot of listeners are going to care that much about Syracuse basketball, but you're going to see Hughes in the NBA. He's on a struggling stretch recently, these last two. I was waving the flag for him to win ACC Player of the Year because last week he was leading the league in points per game. And then this guy, Vernon Carey, we got to talk about him because he's going to be interesting come draft time. I see him in the top 10 on a lot of different boards at this very moment. And his physique is just unbelievable. This guy's the son of an NFL player. Vernon Carey Sr. was picked by the Dolphins 19th overall in 2004. Just a couple picks before Vince Wilfork. And he played from 04 to 11 with the Dolphins. And then this guy just has a mammoth of a son. 270, 6'10". Looks like he should be on the football field playing the same position as his dad. His shoulders are absolutely ginormous. And the way he clears space in the paint, it's not that hard to do against Syracuse. And they've had some losses this year. But he's definitely an intriguing prospect. With his physique and with the fact that he plays that game that no one in the NBA wants anymore, the post-up, sort of akin to the guy playing down there in New Orleans now, came out of Duke himself.
Jahlil Okafor,
yeah. He looks like he has his kind of game, and I think there's going to be a lot of similar concerns, minus the size. He has a ton of weight on Jahlil Okafor, and that might make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of physique, I haven't watched Carey enough, not playing, you know, some of the bigger games, to make any huge judgments about, you know, his playing size. But the thing is, against a team like Cuse, where we've seen over the past 4 years, where it's pretty easy, like you said, to move people around the paint, a body like that, after a while, just grinds and grinds and grinds and just wears you down. And honestly, I know, like you said, the NBA doesn't want a ton of that anymore, but sometimes it's good to have that grinder, you know, game to game, who can just, you know, bang in the paint and get it done.
Duke, man, they rotate them in and year out. Not only that, but they do a lot of cool stuff with these with this talent. They're not just rolling the ball out there and having those guys go to work. They're very methodical. Against the zone, you see it too. The fact that you can get upwards of 30 points with a post center against the zone is creative in itself.
And having someone like Trey Jones is so helpful.
Oh, he's awesome.
To have like a real life point guard out there, second year player, great defender, smart player, good offensive player, that helps so much.
How many good white guys do they have too? It's unbelievable. Like, they just find the best white guys that are great enough to make an impact on this level in college basketball, but we're not going to see Matthew Hurt. Well, maybe we'll see Matthew Hurt one day, but you know, I don't see myself seeing Jack White in the NBA one day. Definitely not O'Connell. Baker. Yeah, O'Connell. There's going to be no O'Connell in the NBA, but you never know nowadays. Some of these guys do develop toward year four.
Especially those who can shoot.
So they broke our heart again. Again, we're sitting here wondering where the next center is going to be. They're looking at a center from Columbia to save things, which isn't great, especially as he's taken a bunch of other visits. He was at the game on Saturday. And, of course, you have another big visit game where they're recruiting guys for 2022, and it ends up being another tough loss against elite competition. Nothing could have been worse than that Virginia game opening night, though. Similar hype, and, man, was that an absolute disaster. So we've come a long way from that point, and it sort of is that same story. We know it well following Syracuse basketball. They're going to improve immensely throughout the year, but the point at which they start off from is so low early in the year that what point do you even get to? It's going to be tough for them to get into the tournament. And for a program that's been so great over the years, you'd like to have a higher bar than that. But we look at this team right now, and you know what they're capable of. Like, the bar has to just be, like, sneaking into the tournament, or maybe even lower, because we weren't even thinking about tournament at the beginning of this year. Now the fact that we are is pretty astonishing. And as much as it's a credit to them, it's also a credit to the league, where everybody stinks, as I say. Across college basketball, it feels like everybody stinks this year, because everyone's losing everybody. The night that Duke beat Syracuse, UNC goes and loses to BC, who Syracuse beat by, like, 25.
Yeah, I mean, either everyone stinks, or it's just more even than, you know, we've come to expect and come to know. There's no one figure, at least it doesn't, you know, I don't think there's any figure like a Zion or a clear-cut number one at this point or anything like that. And I think most of the time when you really feel like there's that number one or that there's a handful of really good teams, it's because you have the great draft stock. And obviously this doesn't look like one of the better drafts that we've seen recently, but
yeah, Ball is going to go in the top three.
I know he is.
RJ Hampton might go top 10, 15, playing in New Zealand. And we lost Wiseman. This is just such a weird
situation. It has been a weird season. I think it's because we're right on the, obviously you have the NCAA bending a little bit on paying the players with, you know, the bills that went through in California. And all this conversation, and the NCAA came out and said they'd be willing to, you know, work with some likeness stuff. I think we're just in a strange place with the NCAA, with college basketball. It could just be this season, but it feels like we're right on the edge of a little kind of transformation, especially if you have one of the top three picks with such hype in terms of family hype, but also basketball player hype, you know, going in the top three from Australia.
We're seeing three layers of changes. Syracuse has gone through it the 4 years we've been here. They're in a transformative stage where they're going to have to figure out what's after Boeheim. And I don't mind it, because we look at what the assistant there is doing, Hopkins in Washington. They're struggling. They're going through it too. Maybe worse than Syracuse.
Yeah, you're not. When I say something better, I don't mean go look for a better coach than Boeheim. I just think at this point, something has to give, because there's a lot of stagnation with this program. Obviously, they're, like I said, they're playing better than I think we expected this year, but
have you gone to any other games besides the Duke one?
Not this year.
Well, that's what a lot of people have done. We're looking at that student section saying, this is awesome, but they're here for Duke. They're not here for the Syracuse team anymore, which is too bad. We get that construction going on around the dome. Things are just transforming. And the media landscape, we're seeing a ton of changes. We're here figuring it out ourselves. And sports as a whole, I feel like baseball, I'm looking back at young A-Rod and what a figure he was. I'm looking back at what college basketball was in the 80s and 90s, what a staple in American sports it was. so many of these different sports we're looking at too, these leagues, these organizations, even these players, everything's just in a transformative stage right now. And I don't know when the dust is going to settle on all this change and we find ourselves in a very stable sports landscape again. Like, it's probably going to be end of this decade, next decade, I'd imagine, if it does at all.
Yeah, like, if it does at all is a good point, because I think the biggest thing that we've seen, you know, throw a wrench into everything is different ways to watch sports. You get these TV deals with standard TV, you know, in the tens of billions of dollars for professional and collegiate sports leagues, and then there's so many different ways, you know, to get around having to get cable, whether that's streaming or legally streaming or illegally streaming. So I think you're seeing a lot gets shifted because of that, and then with the emergence of, not emergence, but the solidification of social media, and you see guys like LeBron and a lot, mostly NBA players, having a real voice, and I think that's where the change is coming from, and it's kind of trickling into other sports where people who have gripes or dislike what's happening in their league are more willing to speak up now, and a lot of the times the people who are willing to speak up have the voice to speak up as well.
That's empowered the individual, and there's a lot of choice for viewers, for the players, for everybody across all the sports landscape. And that's made things a little disjointed. We like this, but when everyone's not centralized in the same places as much as they used to be, whether it's around the TV, whether it's around different programs in sports, or even just college basketball as a whole, things get spread out to a degree that it's tough to follow. People end up forming niches, and there just isn't a national consensus around stuff anymore. I mean, even Twitter itself, we talk about Twitter as this huge platform for discussion. That in itself, I think, is a very niche place to have discussions.
Yeah, and I think a part of it is, too, especially with you and I being the ages we are, you know, approaching, you graduated school, me approaching the end of school at the end of May. We grew up so much differently with sports. From the time we were 12, we had, you know, all the access to NBA Twitter or different levels of ESPN. From the time you and I were very young, we came up. Our first 10 years of media exposure to basketball, in particular, are the most advanced they've ever been. So we didn't even get a lot of the old-time feel in terms of, you know, Jackie Mack covering Larry Bird. Like, you know what I mean? We didn't get a ton of that. So I think our experience has been so crazy, and I don't know if the dust is going to settle, because what's it going to settle to? Our norm has been change.
Yeah, absolutely. Last note I want to take out of the dome is covering Boeheim is so interesting. I want to write about the fact that he's been a gatekeeper for a lot of people who have gone through the school to go on to covering sports, and he's been that first figure that they go through, that first giant figure that they have to cover in their time here. And it really is weird covering this guy, because he handles the media in a way that's so different from anyone I see in sports. You know, a lot of times, you know, we have different ideas that we push onto these figures, and they give their thoughts on it, and then we follow up those thoughts with other people. After this game, he goes on this big speech about Quincy Guerrier, and it looked like he had a pretty good game. You know, we've been writing more and more about this guy having better games. Interesting that Jeff Goodman had him in the top 10 of next year's draft before this year. I mean, we both watched him. He's not even going to the draft next year the way he's played. So he's going on about how he hasn't improved as much as we thought. This is just sort of his own tirade. This wasn't in response to any question. Then he just calls out one of the reporters in the crowd. He's like, you know, I see you going to him and telling him I said something bad about him. And I think that's the worst kind of journalism, paraphrasing that. And I went back and reviewed everything, because this is, you know, a story I wasn't following as much. And it really is just a simplistic, he asked Boeheim about Guerrier. Boeheim probably ripped him. And then he followed up with Guerrier. Guerrier was laughing at it a little bit. He's taken it really well this year. And Boeheim was furious. I mean, he must have come across the article or whatever that those two were connected. And it's just like, that seems like such a simple thing to us. But it's one of those things, the unpredictability of Boeheim really makes him just such an interesting figure for people who go through this school to go on to cover media. Because he's different as a figure than anybody else out there that they go on to encounter. And he's that first taste for the people who start here.
I don't know if it's unexpected at this point. You have the overrated thing with Jerry Mack. You've got plenty of these examples, and obviously that one's a great example, because that's like in support of one of his players. But if you want to rip your players to the media in front of everyone, don't be surprised when the reporter goes and asks the player about it. That's like one of the most basic things that you're
it's the worst kind of journalism.
It's not, yeah, but that's journalism. That's how it works. And if you don't want reporters asking your players about the things you say about your players, then say them behind closed doors. And if you don't want to deal with it all, then don't read the stories. Because if you're saying the stuff and then seeking out the stories, you clearly do care. And whether or not it's the worst kind of journalism ever, it's not. You're contributing to it.
Just another note I want to have out of that one. Fun night. Been a fun season following this team. I thought they'd be done by now, but this is that one time all year we get the spotlight on them. If there's going to be another one, it's going to be in March, and it's going to have a lot of people mad that they're there again after how done they were early this year. Let's talk about the Super Bowl.
What do you think about it?
I loved it. I thought it was a phenomenal game. It was a nice change of pace from the year before. And we get a Patriots-esque comeback. Now, I was talking to Gilman about this earlier. It wasn't 28-3.
But not even close.
We get into 7 minutes to go. They're down 2 touchdowns.
No, right? their biggest deficit was 10 points. 10 points. They were down ten. Tom Brady came back against the Seattle defense down 10 in the fourth quarter. Don't talk to me. Mahomes, it was a great performance. You know, a lot of people are knocking Mahomes for his individual performance. He still orchestrated a fourth quarter comeback in the Super Bowl from 10 points down. That's an accomplishment in and of itself. But I love Mahomes. I think Mahomes is that dude. I think he's going to be one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time. But it's all just calm down.
You had a run team that was in complete control of the pace of this game. And this game was flying. Like, I couldn't believe when the first quarter was over. Then it's halftime. I don't have the time of game offhand, but this felt like one of the faster Super Bowls ever. And that's what the Chiefs had to go up against. They're down 10. There's 7 minutes left. They basically have to do two length of the field drives that they break off with a nice pass to Tyreek Hill to start off all that momentum. And then the big play to Travis Kelce on the second drive with the pass interference there. The explosion that the Chiefs displayed in that 7 minutes to just completely flip this game 180 after it had been in the 49ers' control, the scale of the comeback wasn't as good as 28-3. But the amount of time that they had to do it, the way that the game was going against them, 2 turnovers, the pace out of their hands, them unable to do a lot of stuff in the pocket that they usually do. They had Mahomes running outside it all game long. I found it just a notch under how impressive that Falcons collapse was. And, of course, Kyle Shanahan on both those
stops. That's the bigger issue is Kyle Shanahan. Kyle Shanahan plays to not lose the Super Bowl. He doesn't play to win. If you look at that Philadelphia-New England Super Bowl from 2 years ago, Super Bowl 52, the biggest difference between that and Super Bowl 51, that the Patriots came back 28-3, is that it was clear in the Falcons' game plan that they started playing not to lose. They started to get conservative. They started to play not to make mistakes. Meanwhile, Philly played to beat the Patriots. Philly kept their foot down. Philly kept their foot on the Patriots' neck and beat them. Last night, the Chiefs did just that. They played their game. Meanwhile, Kyle Shanahan, only getting Mozart 12 carries seems wrong after the game he had in the NFC title game and just the season he had. And honestly, every time he touched the ball, it felt like he was, you know, breaking off a chunk of yards. And they just seemed to really go away from the stuff that was working for them. And I think this is another example of Kyle Shanahan playing not to lose instead of playing to win. And it bit him again.
3 layers to this one. Before halftime, they're running out the clock again. And then they decide late that they want to go for this drive, and then they can't convert it. It's something a lot of teams do around the league, and the Patriots are not strangers to that situation either. Like, oh, things are breaking, but we already wasted a lot of the time that we had in the situation. That was the beginning of the end of them second-guessing themselves. And you know what's so funny? A lot of people looked at this game when picking the 49ers, and I had such a hard time picking this game. I just leaned toward the Chiefs a little bit because of their explosiveness. But you can't play the way you usually do in this game because of the scale and because of how things tighten up. So you have 2 high-scoring offenses coming into this one. Knew the score was going to be down a little bit. I mean, the over-under in this one was 54, so they just ended up approaching that at the final score, 31-20. So they're just under that. But all game long, it's a 20-10 game. They're not even approaching that. So things tighten up in an offensive sense. But things tighten up from a decision-making sense, too. Both of these teams, you look at them, are they going to stick to their guns? They didn't. When they give up the first touchdown, they go into that drive where they could have killed all the clock. There was 5-6 minutes left. But they start throwing with Garoppolo. Second down and third down, right?
Yeah, that was an issue.
So that's where I look at Shanahan and I say, he diverted from what worked for them all season long in that spot. And that completely blew it for them. Because the Chiefs get a stop in under a minute there. And they just have endless time to take it to the house on that second drive. And then by the time the 49ers get in on the final drive, Garoppolo is in a position with 90 seconds left where he has to start spreading out the field and throwing it all over the place like he hasn't for much of the season. There's been situations, but the Niners were in such a great spot where they could have played their game, killed this clock, and won it the way they were winning it all game long. And things tightened up on them. They got outside of themselves. The funniest part is, that's what you would have expected Andy Reid to do in this position. And Reid stuck to his guns, throw, keep getting Mahomes back there, tossing it downfield. And who comes out of this game more redeemed than Andy Reid? Coaching circles around Kyle Shanahan is getting credit all year long.
I think there's a two-faceted argument to have here, and it's quarterback-based, and it's Jimmy Garoppolo wasn't required to do a ton to win a lot of games this year because of how good their defense was and how good their run game was. Which, no knock on him. If you need to win football games a certain way, you win football games a certain way. I think Andy Reid has a luxury in being able to call whatever he wants, whenever he wants, because he has Patrick Mahomes on the team. Patrick Mahomes, in his first two seasons as a starting quarterback, has a 50-touchdown MVP season and now a Super Bowl MVP season in his first two seasons as a starter. So I think that's the biggest reason. I think that's the biggest reason. No prediction in terms of, you know, longevity of Mahomes' career, but I think that's the reason you're going to end up seeing the Chiefs win more games than they lose over the course of his career is because they have Mahomes and the other team doesn't.
It's going to completely change Reed's career, but you got to give him and the organization credit because they draft him, they develop him, and they move on from Alex Smith, who was awesome for years there, to get to this guy, which is something the 49ers did back in the day with Colin Kaepernick, who didn't appear in the broadcast at all. And people were talking about that online, intentional or not, because it seemed hard for me to believe that they don't even go once. Oh, last time the 49ers were here, Colin Kaepernick was the quarterback.
I think in terms of that, that's a strange move in, you know, bringing that up. You would think to believe it's intentional. I don't know if it was intentionally malicious to leave him out, but I do think that there is an intent to erase him from, you know, what we've been dealing with the NFL as football fans for the past, you know, 3 or 4 years. So I think, I don't know if yesterday there was an effort to specifically, you know, erase or diminish or just not talk about Colin Kaepernick, but I think there is an overall effort to do that, and that fits right into the puzzle.
Do you like Miami Stadium as a site for the game?
Yes. I think when you can tell the game is outdoors, it's just so much different. It feels different. Obviously, the Patriots, not complaining about the Patriots playing in the Super Bowl as often as they have. They've played a lot of Super Bowls in domes. And there's something about it. Like, you know, Super Bowl 50 with Carolina and Denver a couple years ago in the new Niners Stadium. Something about it just, it looks so much better.
They got perfect weather.
Yeah.
They had the drones flying from the outside of the stadium in for those overhead views. Phenomenal. Love the seating, love the colors there. And everything was just Miami.
And it was a good football game. I mean, there have been so many Patriots Super Bowls are very fun for Patriots fans, but I can understand why they're not for other fan bases. Yesterday was a solid football game.
And you had the fans after staying there for a long time. Longer than most do, I feel like. They hadn't won in a long time, which plays into that. But it felt like the right team won from a celebration standpoint. Awesome celebrations after. Tyrann Mathieu winning was cool. He had a lot to say after this one. Travis Kelce had the tears in his eyes. Pat Mahomes redeemed because he was so bad early in this game. Some of the turnovers he had. But man, Andy Reid, we could do a whole episode about this guy. The redemption, the turnaround, and just him being such a gracious figure in winning that game. Thanking everybody, the link to Philadelphia. He was just in his glory, and there's not a lot to him. You know, he won the AFC title game when he got a cheeseburger, a celebration, and I didn't hear how he celebrated this one, but very simple guy, great coach in the NFL history, and he always got crap for what happened in Philadelphia at the end, and for the time management issues, which he figured out this season. I felt like we didn't hear that about him all year long this year.
I'm telling you, things are much easier when you have the best player in football.
It's trade deadline season. Trade deadline's coming up Thursday. We'll hit more on this later in the week, probably the day of or the day after in reaction to it. But that also means rumor season. And we started getting some rumors. The two big ones right now, Clint Capela being shopped around the league, which is no abnormal thing for him. Because what do the Rockets do every year? They don't have picks. They don't have top-end players. They just have Harden and a bunch of role guys. So what they do every year is they shop those expensive role guys as if they're marquee pieces around the league. And Eric Gordon, PJ Tucker, and Clint Capela become the guys most likely to be dealt around the league every single deadline. It never happens, and it's not going to happen again this year because teams aren't going to give them great pieces for their spare part role guys. No disrespect to them because they're great role guys, but still, they're not going to upgrade off those guys by just using those guys. It's a very arrogant thing, almost akin to how the Lakers think they're going to get everybody every year, even though they did these last 2 years.
Yeah, I think something like, I saw a report that said they were looking for Smart in a first for Clint Capela, or something like that, or Tice in a first, or something ridiculous along those lines. I don't want to trade Daniel Tice for Clint Capela. I don't want to move anything foolish for Clint Capela as a Celtics fan, or even as a, you know, NBA fan in general. I think if you can get a guy like that for something reasonable, obviously that's a move you want to make. But in terms of some of the stretches you hear, especially, why would anyone in the league want to bail Houston out? They traded for Chris Paul. They messed up. They traded for Russell Westbrook. Obviously, that is what it is. Last year, the owner was saying, you know, go find that third superstar. The luxury tax doesn't matter. Today, I'm seeing reports that says the Houston owner wants to get back under the luxury tax and is willing to shed salary. Why should other teams want to bail that out?
They undermine themselves.
Of course they do.
Again and again. And they do it every year, and there's a reason none of these guys have moved in these countless hypothetical scenarios.
It's the reason I'm fine with the Celtics building the way they are right now. After last year's, you know, debacle with that team, I'm fine with this Celtics team not making rash moves for the sake of making rash moves.
Absolutely. And I look at Houston and this deadline, and we hear a lot of different rumors this time of year, but they're always coming from one source. And that source is going to have a motive, and I feel like a lot of the stuff we hear about Houston is coming out of Houston, about how they're ready to make a move using these pieces. But you don't hear teams around the league saying, we're dying for Capela, we're dying for Gordon. These just aren't pieces that are as envied around the league. One guy I know that's going to be envied in many different destinations, and we know of one very well, the Minnesota Timberwolves have been dying for this guy for years now, and it doesn't feel like they're going to be able to get their hands on him because they haven't to this point. But where is D'Angelo Russell going to go? Because the Warriors, still crazy to think about, they played the Celtics on ESPN last week, and I was stunned to just see how irrelevant they are at this point. Even with him playing, even with Steph Curry on the verge returning, they're going to be in the play for the number one pick, which is just nuts when we go back to a year ago at this point. So you want Russell, who I listened to the League Pass commercial. They mentioned this guy in the League Pass commercial. Like, you want to see these marquee guys like Russell. So he's going to be in a place this year, which isn't Minnesota, that is able to showcase him in the playoffs and have him be part of what the NBA product's going to be late in this season. Because this guy can't just wilt away in Golden State. He's obviously not part of their future plans. So they're going to move him by Thursday. He's the guy I want to see move. And I don't know where he's going to end up. I guess if I had a guess, you could see a team like, I don't know, Orlando making a move at him at the bottom of the East. Someone just trying to make a boost at a playmaking spot that could use him to improve and compete better in the playoffs. Because we saw what the Nets were with him versus what they are with Irving now. Not to say that was the only trade-off they made, because they have Jordan and they're stinking too. But Russell had a phenomenal impact on a 6 seed who pushed the 76ers last year. So I want to see him on an underachieving, lower seed team and have that turn things around.
I've been a big fan of D'Angelo Russell since he was in college at Ohio State, and I still am. I'd love to see him in Minnesota because I think...
They can't make the playoffs, though.
Probably not, but I think the off-court chemistry with Karl Anthony Towns would translate to on-court chemistry, and I think that would be a fun one, too, to watch. I think that at some point, Russell's going to play with Devin Booker or Karl Anthony Towns. I think that's inevitable.
Phoenix makes sense because they're on the edge of the playoffs and could get in.
I wouldn't hate that. I think that would be a cool... an interesting pairing. Obviously, you're going to have to deal with money stuff no matter how you do this because Russell did sign a big contract. D'Angelo Russell, I don't know what he does for a bottom of the pack Eastern Conference team in terms of a playoff push. I think that he's a player that, honestly, I could see the Warriors holding on to. And at this point in my mind, the Warriors are going to hold on to. I think I disagree with a lot of people. I don't know if he's necessarily a part of their future plans or was an integral part of their future plans, but I don't think it's crazy to think that I think he could fit within what the Warriors do. So I don't think it would be crazy if the Warriors did just hold on to him and, you know, a lineup of Curry, Russell, Klay Thompson, and Draymond, I don't hate that top four for next year.
All right, we'll stick more on deadline later in the week. We got some good thoughts off on this one. I didn't see too much floating around on the trade line that today. That Capella one dropped like a bomb. And, of course, Houston's just stirring up that market because they're always trying to do something with their GM and that whole staff down there. Things are just always constantly rotating around that team for better and for worse. I'll be rooting for them in the playoffs if the Celtics are going to be making a charge because that's someone I'd rather see versus the Lakers, the Clippers come championship time if they could get there. But other than that, I don't see a lot of noise around them. It's interesting that they moved the deadline up. I think that's going to put a lot of teams in a weird spot later this week. Who's in contention, who isn't, especially at the bottom of the East. The bottom of the West is pretty crowded, too, at this point. So teams like Memphis, Phoenix, Orlando, even Brooklyn, those teams all have some interesting decisions to make. And Minnesota, I'm not going to see them in the playoffs, no. I don't think. So,
no.
Taylor McLeod is our producer. I'm Bobby Manning. We'll see you back in Boston when I'm there later this week for some Celtics stuff, trade deadline, and whatever comes out of this Tom Brady situation when we finally start hearing more on that. This is Dome Theory. Get us on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, all those platforms. See you later in the week.